One of my favorite shows on Netflix is a series called Dear White People. Any of you watch it? Right. Okay, so there's a movie called Dear White People. This is the series. It has a multiple seasons. It's set at a fictional Ivy League school that is primarily white, and it centers around a character named Samantha, who's black, and who hosts a radio show on campus called Dear White People, thus the name of the series. So in her radio show, she tries to explain to the white students all the things they seem pretty oblivious to when it comes to race and racism on campus. Sam's show is, and she really is, bold, unwavering, sometimes funny, in a somewhat heartbreaking way, courageous, and very clear about what's right and wrong. Which is why you probably aren't surprised that by season three, Sam has a troll. And we know what a troll is, right? Generally. Okay, you don't have to be shy if you don't. You can just, no, I don't know what a troll is. I said at the last service, I felt like this was a little demographic information about our different services, how many people knew what the term troll was at any of our three services. So just in case, you don't have to admit, but just in case you aren't sure what a troll is someone who comes at someone online anonymously, like aggressively. And in this case, Sam didn't just get any troll. She got a right-wing extremist, something that we might now think of as like a bot, right? Something that's just repeating old lines, a white nationalist troll. She should, of course, ignore the troll. That is standard troll protocol, like 101. You just deprive the troll of oxygen, they fade away. But of course, Sam does not ignore the troll. She engages directly, actually starts talking back, and then in turn, the troll's audience grows until the troll seems to be everywhere, not a bot at all, commenting on really specific things that she's not even just saying online, but about her life on campus. She tries to be strong through all of this, through these attacks, but eventually it does get to her. She doubts herself, and she really starts to get scared. So her friends around her, the black community especially around her, they decide that they're going to figure this out. Who is this troll? And eventually they do figure it out. The troll, it turns out, is one of their friends, somebody from within their community. He's a guy that's Mexican-American, and he's gay. Like a leader in the work for gay rights on campus. To say that the community is shocked is a huge understatement. Like, it just doesn't make any sense. How could one of their friends, like, hurt Sam in this way, hurt all of them like that? And in turn, like, how could he align himself with the white nationalists and, like, the men's rights group on campus? I mean, and really, ultimately, just how could he be so mean? It was unbelievable. They trusted him. And he lied and betrayed them. And worse, they were really mad at themselves for not having seen it sooner, for trusting him in the first place. He'd betrayed them, but really they felt like they had betrayed themselves. I think we all have a story like this in our lives. Maybe a lot of stories, actually. A story where someone that we trust turns out to be a person that's not the person we thought they were. I mean, somebody who we thought was a good person, not a saint necessarily, but someone who was trustworthy, who turns out to not be. In my life, the earliest one that I can remember when I think back was when I was not quite 12. I was in seventh grade. I started school a little early, so I was 11. It was the beginning of the year, and I was running for class president in seventh grade. And my good friend had agreed, when I asked her, she was willing to be my campaign manager. So one day at recess, I overheard her talking to other, and she was like crowded with a bunch of other friends. And I was like, oh, great. She's really spreading the message. So I went over to listen in, and it turns out that she was telling them how stupid it was that I was running for class president because I was so annoying, so full of myself. I was so hurt. I was so angry. So this girl, she had long blonde hair. It was straight, went right down to her back. She was, she was known as this long blonde hair. So I went over and I yanked her long blonde hair, and she turned around and she grabbed me and by my shoulders, and she kicked me in the shins, and I kicked her right back. I didn't even think. And then I pulled harder on her long blonde hair. It was one of the few times I was really glad to have short hair growing up, and it was permed, so she couldn't even get in there. Before long, the teacher was blowing her whistle, getting between us, sending us to the principal's office. Now, to be clear, this was like crazy out of character for me. I did not get into fights. I mean, I didn't even lose my temper. It was, I definitely did not hurt other people. Actually, my mom tells me that when the principal called her to tell her about this, she actually laughed when the principal called. She said, "You definitely have the wrong kid." But she didn't. I mean, I trusted her. She was my friend. And I mean, so much so that I asked her to be my campaign manager. I thought she could see the most for me. She was my classmate that I'd known. We actually had been in school together since preschool. I trusted her, and she had betrayed my trust. This word trust, we use it quite often, so much so it can feel a little squishy, like we're not really sure what are we actually talking about when we say we trust someone. I want to take a moment then just to define our terms with a definition from Charles Feltman. Now, if you Google Charles Feltman, this is a little side note, but if you Google Charles Feltman, you're like, who's that guy that Gretchen referenced? You'll find that the first Charles Feltman that comes up is the guy who invented a hot dog. Not that one. This Charles Feltman, that would not be a very reliable source in this case. But this Charles Feltman, he wrote a book called Trust. So a more reliable source. He says that trust is when we choose to make something important to you vulnerable to the actions of someone else. Let me say it just one more time to kind of feel how it feels for you. Trust is when you choose to make something that's important to you vulnerable to the actions of someone else. That something important might be words, stories, your seventh grade campaign to be class president, values that you share, work you'd want accomplished. In the ordination ceremony yesterday, we were all expressing an act of trust as we invited Kristen into a whole lot of things that are important to us, right? And then in turn, making them vulnerable to her actions. Ministry and church work is in every moment, every day, every breath, an act of trust. And it's like that in all relationships, really. There is no relationship without trust. Every day, every moment, every breath of our relationships is an act of trust, which also means, of course, that our relationships in every moment, every breath, are vulnerable to betrayals of that trust. I mean, vulnerability is built into the very definition of trust, right? When we choose to make something that's important to us vulnerable to the actions of someone else. Relationship counselor John Gottman offers a really great example of this. He tells a story about one night when he was just about to finish a book that he was really into. It was like he said it was a great book, and all he wanted to do was get up, put on his pajamas, brush his teeth, and hurry back and finish the book. So he was on his way to do that, And when all of a sudden he could see out of the corner of his eye his wife, and he could tell that something's going on with her. She looks really sad, stressed, kind of upset. And as he moves by, he thinks, don't make eye contact. Because all he wants to do is go back to his book, right? Anyone relate? Yeah, right. And what Gottman says is that when we make those choices to keep going, that is a kind of betrayal of trust, a break of trust in those moments. Because on the other hand, when we do decide to stop, when we kind of say, okay, the book can hold, we decide to connect, even in a small way, when we invite someone to make whatever is going on with them vulnerable to us, that in turn strengthens trust. It builds trust. And in turn strengthens our relationship. We usually shrug these small moments off, right? Kind of saying, I understand. You know, I like to read to get to the end of my book too. But over time, they can add up. Or really, they can wear us down. They can erode trust in a relationship and erode us. Whether with a partner or a friend, family member, or even just strangers around us, how someone pays attention to us in those small moments, makes the connection, treats us just like a fellow human being in the small everyday moments. It adds up or it wears us down. And so much keeps us from those moments today, keeps us practiced in these small betrayals, just the busyness of our lives, our screens, let alone depression, anxiety, trauma. No wonder trust seems to be in short supply these days. No wonder we don't often know who to trust or what, if anything, is worthy of our trust. Every day, every breath, we are practicing breaking trust or building it. Still, these small betrayals, these little moments, at least in and of themselves, they don't usually undo a relationship. Like I said, we move through them. They don't often make repair or a return to trust seem impossible. It's more like the betrayals that I talked about in the Dear White People moment, right? When those betrayals that aren't just like you missed one small moment, but it's like you were never really there in any of the moments. When it becomes clear that the person that we thought we knew was actually just all made up. At least it feels that way, like it's performance. So much so that our whole relationship, like our whole past as we knew it, feels like it's a lie, like it's all up for grabs. And this undoing of our past and who we were, this is what undoes us, undoes the relationship, makes it feel like you just can't recover. In her book, The State of Affairs, Esther Perel reminds us that while most of us are willing to concede that the future is unpredictable, we expect the past to be dependable, right? We get that the future is in flux. It's like, basically come to terms with that. But the past, it needs to stay as it was. So the disrupting the story that we have about our past, it can disrupt us so terribly, make us question ourselves, our whole sense of self, which can become untenable. We can't live without that cohesive sense of self, at least not for long, so that we need a way to kind of settle things back down, get things back in their boxes. And it's then that the old ideas, where some people are bad, other people are good, I'm the good one, those are the bad ones, can be really appealing. Right? Those clean lines that help us restabilize our sense of self, our sense of the past, is you can start to think, okay, well, that disrupted my whole sense of the past, but that what was really going on there was that turned out to be a bad person. It can be really comforting. I used that word earlier, troll. It's an old word, really, but is a new use. And even this word, that draws that clear line about somebody that we can just dismiss, right? I mean, deprive the troll of oxygen. It can be a helpful term, really. Comforting. Help make sense of the world. Even ideas like sin or sinner, even evil. It can be such a comfort, such a help when our past feels like it's been torn out from under us. It can be a comfort to say some people are bad and broken, maybe irreparably. And it can be a comfort to say that when everything we know feels like it's come undone. Because if that's true, then maybe it's also true that if we could just study those people, learn their ways, then we could avoid them and the pain that they bring. We could be okay again. We could stabilize our sense of self, our sense of the past. We could be not perfect people, we never claimed that, but fundamentally good and whole, just like most other people. This is basically the story that is the cohesive story that Unitarian Universalists have relied on for a long time. That for the most part, humans are trustworthy and good, that betrayals are rare. Evil, it's like an occasional outlier that could be prevented in most cases through good communication, stable family life, and proper education, especially advanced degrees. Right? If you can just have communication, good family life, most evil will take care of itself. Rather than original sin, we tend to talk about original blessing, the inherent worth and dignity of every person, and we have a generally optimistic view of human nature. We emphasize the need to trust, that all relationships are built on trust in the everyday and every moment, just like I've been saying, except that somehow we tend to skip over the vulnerable part. We tend to treat trust like it's a guarantee. And if we just can trust, then people are trustworthy. This version of trust, it can be such a good way to live, actually. Science and much of the world's spiritual teachings teach us that actually what we focus on grows, so that when we focus on human goodness, in many cases, human goodness grows. It's just that when human goodness is all we have, minus those rare outliers that can mostly be prevented, then when someone in our lives doesn't choose the good and instead chooses the hurtful, or the deceitful. Someone we admire chooses the racist, the sexist, especially someone that we love, someone we trust. It could be so hard to make sense of it. Because even more than just the betrayal itself, which is disrupting enough, painful enough, it makes us question the whole story that we've relied on. So that often in that confusion, we get caught in either a boundaryless compassion or a strict and quick judgment, like yank that blonde hair. Right? We end up in a binary where either we say to someone we love who has acted hurtfully, it's okay, I love you anyway, you're still a good person. We just try to let it go, whatever it is, try not to think about it. Or we let them go. We end the relationship. We can't even think about them because we can't make sense of their behavior in our model, our story, where you're either a good person or you're an evil outlier. So we just try to forget about it, or we forget about them. But the problem is, as we move through life and through our relationships, especially long-term relationships, sooner or later, those stories are going to start to add up. Pile up. Sooner or later, we have a whole stack of people that either we've written off or a whole bunch of others that we're harboring resentment towards. Because it turns out we don't just let it go. Right? As Richard Rohr has said, pain that is not transformed is transmitted. Right? The pain doesn't just go away. Which is to say that inevitably this stack, these stories that add up, it includes ourselves. The small and big ways that we fail ourselves.
way we fail those we love.
So I think we need a different way, another story that can take in all of this, something that is actually cohesive. That is the trust and the betrayals of trust that are everywhere in us, all of us, all the time. We need a story about humanity that is more than an emphasis on human goodness with just an occasional, mostly preventable outliers. Earlier, I quoted from Esther Perel. I wonder if any of you have had the pleasure of reading any of Esther Perel's books. She has a few out there, or she has a TED Talk, too, if you're into TED Talks. The one, The State of Affairs, first of all, she's so brilliant. Go find her books. They're amazing, and her TED Talk as well. She also has a podcast. This is not in the script, but this summer in my sabbatical, I listened to, I called it my Summer of 1,000 podcasts because I got to listen to all the podcasts. And one of them was her podcast, and it's actually, she goes directly into couples counseling. She brings you into a session with couples. Fascinating. Anyway, but her book, The State of Affairs, it looks directly at infidelity, right? The state of affairs. But her ideas apply really well to all the ways that we practice and break trust with one another. And what I appreciate most about her model is that she takes a really honest look at how common cheating is. It's really common across all sorts of demographics and circumstances. And in this process, she never imagines that there are some types of people that cheat, the bad people, the sinners. And then there are others that would never cheat, the good people, right, the saints. She doesn't say that. She doesn't say we're mostly good people either with occasional bad ones. But also, she doesn't say that we're all just broken sinners either, that we're perpetually bad. And at the same time, she doesn't back away from the impact and the pain that betrayal causes, nor the possibility that sometimes a relationship cannot be repaired, that trust cannot be restored. Instead, she offers us a view of human nature that says we are all both sinner and saint all the time. A story that says that these acts of betrayal are not just the small ones, are regular and everyday, that they're a part of us, all of us. And most importantly, she makes it clear that these moments of betrayal need not be the end of the story. When we can deal directly with the impact of what has happened, that is, not just try to let it go, minimize it, or just forget about someone, but actually stay put and deal with it. When people can take responsibility for these failures, for these breaks in trust that we all practice. Whether we're talking about the bigger betrayals or the small ones along the way, when we can acknowledge that hurt and the loss, the impact, the trust that was broken, then we can make space for something else to happen. Make space for grace, for change, for healing, however you want to think about it, something else to be possible. And in that, there's no guarantees, especially about the time frame, about what's going to happen, when. There's no guarantees. There's just the space for something else to happen. Like we talked about last week, we make space for the unfathomable vastness of the universe to show up. One of my teachers, the somatic worker, Resma Manikim, he talks about how, he says that healing the world, if we're really serious about it, healing the world, we need to imagine that that's the work that will take 7 generations. 7 generations. And I bring that up here because I think it helps to remember that even if broken trust cannot be healed in this lifetime, it still doesn't mean that that's the end of the story. 7 generations. I find this idea so freeing and such good news. Because in this world where trust does seem to be in short supply, where it's hard to know who or what to trust, which can be so wearing, really, and lonely. It's freeing to know that we can simply take the leap to trust more often. Not as a guarantee that our trust won't be broken, even knowing up front that it likely will be, because we are all practicing betrayals of trust and trust all the time. We can know that when that small or big betrayal comes, it need not be the end of the story. It need not be the whole story or the end of the story. That our worst moments are not our whole story, and our best ones aren't either. Because love and life and grace keep showing up. Love and life and grace keep showing up. When we keep showing up, ready to begin again. Amen.